So for some reason that's not comprehensible to me at all, my mind has sort of been turning in more of a Zen direction. That happens. But I mean, the way that we've been teaching mostly is in the Tibetan tradition, but Kay and I both have practiced also in the Zen tradition. In fact, my first teacher was a Zen teacher, so in some way it comes kind of naturally. But anyway, what I wanted to talk about is related to the practice that we're doing, even though it comes out of sort of a, even though I want to start with a Zen story. So, okay, so I'm going to kind of link everything together. There are various books of Zen stories, and there's one called the Mumon Kan, and it's divided into cases. So this is case 29. It's called Ino's Flag. Ino is Japanese for the name of the sixth patriarch of the Zen tradition, who's in Chinese called Huineng. I'm not pronouncing it correctly because I don't speak Chinese, but it'll have to do. Anyhow, Huineng. there's certain teachers that I have a particular affinity for, and he's one of them. Atisha is another one, and I don't know why are these things the case. Who knows? I have no idea. Anyway, so I'm going to read the story, and then we'll talk about this, and eventually it'll become clear why we're talking about this. I hope. You never know. So case 29 is Ino's flag or Huineng's flag. So the wind was flapping a temple flag, and two monks were arguing about the flag. One said, "The flag is moving." The other said, "The wind is moving." They could not agree, no matter how hard they debated. The sixth patriarch, Ino, happened to come by and said, "Not the wind, not the flag. It is the mind that is moving." The two monks were struck with awe. So this is one of those kind of typical, what the heck does that mean, Zen stories, you know, really concise and, you know, what does it mean? So some context. So Huineng, or the sixth patriarch, lived in Tang Dynasty, China. And so he probably lived in the 7th or the 8th century A.D., quite a long time ago. And by some accounts, Buddhism came to China around the 2nd century A.D. And a lot of scholarly apparatus came along with it. And when one thinks about Chinese Buddhism or Japanese Buddhism, one doesn't tend to think about it as having a really scholarly dimension to it. But in these ancient days, it did. But there were three great anti-Buddhist persecutions in China at this time. And the most scholarly Buddhist traditions didn't survive the persecution of the 840s. So what did survive, though, was Zen and also devotional Buddhism or Pure Land Buddhism. So the point is, though, in Huineng's time, the scholarly tradition was still alive. But you wouldn't see it necessarily in this particular story. I mean, basically what the story is, there are two monks in a courtyard. They're having a debate. I mean, this is a story. There's a pennant or a flag flapping in the breeze, and they're having what seems like a nonsensical argument about this. And the patriarch walks out there, and he basically says, "It's your mind that's flapping already. Come on, you know." And that's the story. But as with many Zen stories, it has multiple levels of dimension, multiple levels. Now, you could say one level is, here are these two Zen monks, and they're yakking and yammering and so on and so forth, and the patriarch comes out and says, "No, it's not a matter of the flags flapping or the winds blowing or whatever. It's like, your mind is flapping all over the place. Just shut up already and get on with things." That would be the usual superficial interpretation, Zen interpretation, you know, still your mind and, you know, stop letting your mind flap. But I've always felt that there was another level of interpretation to it. Now, maybe I read it someplace and I forgot that I read it, so I'm stealing it from D.T. Suzuki or something. So if I am, and I don't remember, pardon me, Dr. Suzuki or whoever I'm stealing it from. I mean, it's kind of in my brain, and so now you get it, and I don't remember where it came from. I doubt that it's some creative, you know, impulse on my part, but you never know, it might be. So, traditionally, Buddhism is, traditionally the Buddha is said to have taught three basic forms of teaching, which are called the three turnings of the wheel of the Dharma, the wheel of law. And the first is usually referred to as the Hinayana or Theravada, and currently it's the kind of Buddhism you'd find in Southeast Asia. The second turning is the Mahayana turning, and that's the kind of Buddhism that Tibetan Buddhism is in Mahayana, but in fact all of East Asian Buddhism is Mahayana. And then the third turning is called the mind-only school, or Chittamatra. And I'm not going to explain what those things mean right now, but those are the three turnings of the wheel. And the reason the Buddha taught these three different ways was he had three different kinds of disciples. The first kind of disciples he taught to with the first turning, the second type, blah, blah, and the third type, so on and so forth. Well, clearly this is a later scholarly interpretation of this vast corpus of Buddhist teachings when the later practitioners are trying to make sense of all the different things the Buddha taught. Some of these things even seem contradictory to each other. And what they realized was that the Buddha taught certain things to certain disciples based upon their ripeness, that certain people had a certain frame of mind and they could understand certain kinds of things, and they needed a certain kind of remedy for what was troubling them. But other people had a different type of mind and they needed a different type of remedy for what was troubling them. And so the three turnings were the way that the later scholars organized this and basically said there are three fundamental types of mind, if you will, which they saw as being hierarchical, some more advanced than the others. And then they said, so the Buddha, you know, ran into those three types of mind and he taught in three different kinds of way, and those are called the three turnings. So, you know, depending upon whether you're conservative or more scholarly and critical in the way you think about things, you know, this really is what the Buddha did. You know, first he taught one thing, and then he taught another thing, then he taught a third thing. Or it's the scholars interpreting this big mass of what he taught. Who knows? Actually, I don't think it really makes a whole lot of difference, personally. So, what is the point that I'm trying to make here? Well, the point I'm trying to make here is you can understand this story about Huineng and the flapping pennant. It's usually called a pennant rather than a flag, but we call it flag too. You can understand this story of the flapping flag. Maybe that's why they call it pennant. Flapping flag is hard. A flapping pennant. You can understand that from the point of view of the three turnings. Because you could say that the first monk who says that the flag is moving is a realist. Because what he's saying is that movement is in the nature of the flag. That there's a real flag there and its characteristic is to move. Because flags move. That's one of the things flags do. That's the difference between a flag and, I don't know, laundry on a line or something like that. It's in the nature of flags to move. So he's a realist. And the first turning of the wheel of the law was a teaching for realists. So the Buddha taught realists about the origins of suffering and the ends of suffering. And he didn't say it's all an illusion. He didn't say it's all in your mind. He said, this is real, you know. You have a problem. This is the solution to your problem. And he didn't get metaphysical at all. So the first monk represents the mentality of the first turning the wheel of the law. He's a realist. Movement is in the flag. Okay. Now the second monk, who's saying, no, it's the wind that's moving, right? He's characteristic of the Mahayana middle way tradition. And the reason for that is he is taking the position that wind is what makes the flag move. So the cause is wind, and the movement of the flag is a result. And the whole Mahayana tradition is based upon this idea of what's usually called dependent arising rather than cause and effect, which is that everything that happens happens as a result of causes in this incredible complexity of circumstances. And what we say in a modern genre is everything is connected to everything. And the middle way is a way of understanding that we are situated in a mode of existence in which we appear to be independent and we appear to be substantial, but in fact, we're this incredible transitory collection of parts which is constantly changing, and that everything that we experience is subject to that kind of change, right? And everything that we experience is a result of causes. And therefore, one of the practices of the middle way is accumulating the causes that produce the results you want, because you understand that everything's mutable, so you're not bound by what's going on. You actually have huge freedom in that situation, because since everything arises in dependence upon other things, you have the ability to put in place causes that produce happiness, liberation, enlightenment, good outcomes for other people. That's called altruism. That's all within your capacity. And that's because nothing has a fundamental reality in the way the realist sees it as having a fundamental reality. So that's the second monk who's saying, no, it's the wind. All right, so he represents the Mahayana. So Huineng comes along, he says, no, it's your mind that's flapping. So what he represents is what's called the third turning of the wheel, or the mind-only school. And what he's saying is, what your experience is, what you think is other than yourself, is really your own mind. And it's your mind that's moving. It's your mind that's creating all these situations. Now, it's very easy to fall into sort of a Western notion of idealism, or solipsism, in fact, when you look at things from this point of view. And this is not what the Buddhist teaching is. What Huineng is saying here is that we know that the perceptual process and everything that we experience is a perception, whether it's a perception of a physical object or a perception of a thought or a perception of an emotion. I mean, because all of our interstates, we're also perceiving those interstates. There is awareness and there is an object of awareness. It may be a thought or it may be a feeling, but nevertheless, it is a perception. Okay. Huineng is saying that in every moment of apparent objective experience, your mind is fully engaged in constructing that reality. And your mind is in that reality as much as the objective reality is there. So as much as there's a flag there, there's a mind there. And the mind is creating the flag, if you will, in the perceptual process. And because the mind moves, the flag appears to move. That sounds a little strange, but if you understand that what time is a dynamic process, the objective, apparent objective reality is moving, the apparent subjective reality is moving, they're moving together, and there's this construction. Okay. So Huineng is saying it's your mind that's flapping. In other words, you're perceiving movement because your mind perceives movement. But he's not saying that there's no objective reality there. And it's easy to fall into making that mistake. Okay. So, for example, in a more modern sense, what some teachers have talked about is to think about our experience of reality as being like a movie. You know, it's like we create this drama, you know, it's sort of like the light coming through the projector, passing through the film, and then it's displayed on a screen and we get totally involved in it, and we call that our reality. So this is like a metaphor, if you will, for our reality. But the point is that there actually has to be a film for the light to go through in order for those images to exist, for us to suspend our notions of reality and get identified with, right? So, I mean, you know, you go to a movie theater, and in the very beginning, there are the credits, and you're sort of sitting there, and you're eating popcorn, and it's like it's a movie, right? But if it's a good movie, pretty soon the way the story unfolds gets you hooked in. And if it's a 90-minute movie, by the time 60 minutes have gone by, you're not out there watching a movie, you're totally into the space of the movie, and it's your reality, and you're identified with what's happening, and you've forgotten that you're separate from it, if it's good, and if the seats aren't too hard or something like that. You know, if somebody doesn't have a cell phone on behind you or whatever the case may be. So that kind of full involvement in the movie is kind of, from the third turning the wheel point of view, you know, we, because of the way our minds work, engage with a constructed reality. But there has to be something objective. You know, there has to be a, some, there has to be a movie screen. There has to be film for this to happen. But we don't actually know the nature of that. We only know the nature of our mind constructing things. We don't know the objective thing that our mind relates to construct our experience. We only know our own experience. So what gets tricky about this school of thought is it's very easy to fall into an extreme idealistic point of view and say, oh, it's all only my mind and there's no objective reality. And that's not what Buddhists are saying. But what they are saying is the only thing you experience is your own mind. And you have to logically accept, because there's no other intelligible interpretation, you have to logically accept that there's some kind of objective reality out there, or you run into all the problems of idealism. I mean, how would it be that Jane and I construct more or less the same reality unless there is some external basis that we shared that we both construct? Now, of course, you can go down all kinds of interesting lines of reasoning about this. You could actually go down the line of, no, that's not necessary. The only thing is that we share a subjective reality, and that's why we agree on things. I mean, you can get into all kinds of, your mind can go into all kinds of craziness. It'll flap all over the place, if you will. You know? But the point is, within the Buddhist context, there are these three turnings of the wheel. So why am I sharing this with you? Well, so the practice that we're doing is a practice where we work with an image of our own Buddha nature, right? So if we're practicing Green Tara, you know, we're understanding that Green Tara represents a certain aspect of our Buddha nature, fearless compassion, if you will, and that by meditating ourselves as Green Tara, by holding that image and identifying ourselves with that image rather than our usual mundane self, by identifying ourselves with that image, we are identifying ourselves with our actual Buddha nature, which we're usually out of touch with. And that's the reason for the practice. And the reason for practicing calm abiding with that, or one point of meditation on that image, is to not be distracted by things so that you have the opportunity to see deeply into your own nature, and like a window that that passes light in two directions, you see more deeply into your own nature. And your own deepest nature also expresses itself through you. It's kind of like a two-way street. So that your own Tara nature becomes more manifest in yourself as you practice Tara more, and you see your own Tara nature as you practice Tara more. It's kind of this weird paradox, but I think it kind of makes sense. So what Hui Ning is actually suggesting in the context of this kind of tantric practice, well, I've missed a piece here. When Tibetans try to explain how tantra works, when they try to explain sort of the psychology of tantra, they always say we have to make the explanation based upon the mind-only school or the Chittamatra school or the third turning, because the kind of psychology that we need in order to explain how this practice works is not found in the other two turnings. It's only found in the third turning. Although we as Tibetans consider that the highest philosophical point of view is the Mahayana second turning, to explain the practice of Tantra, we have to depend on the third turning. Right? So this idea that Hui Ning is expressing and the way it relates to our own practice is that what's right here that we're experiencing, this perception, this world that we're constructing, this perceptual process which constructs a world, is the only thing that there is, and that when we meditate ourselves as Tara, we're meditating ourselves right here as Tara. It's very easy to think that, okay, now I'm meditating myself as Tara. I'm someplace else. I'm like in another space. I'm like another person. I'm in a rarefied state of consciousness. I'm sort of like not in the mundane world. It's very easy to, especially when the practice begins to bear fruit, and one of the fruits of practice is bliss, is joy, or whatever the word that you like for this. One of the fruits of practice is this kind of buoyant feeling, which we don't ordinarily have in daily life. And so it's very easy to think, that's what I want. I don't want to do the laundry. I don't want to do the dishes. I don't want to go to work, you know? Nuts to all this. I want to sit here and meditate and enjoy myself. Like, oh, green Tara, this is so nice. It's like this other place that you want to be, right? And so you begin to feel like there's this world and then there's some other kind of world. There's a nice meditative world and then there's the world of laundry, and that those are two separate things. Okay.
And
but,
they are.
But the Zen tradition is very strongly saying no. Yeah. The world of laundry is the place where you practice. It's not only the place where you practice, it's the only place that there is. And if you bring the enlightened mind into that place, then it's as joyful and buoyant as anything else. Because it's the mind that's flapping, and that's all there is. There is what's right here, and what's right here can be something that's experienced buoyantly and happily, or something that's experienced as this is a drag, right? But it's just this right here. And in the Vajrayana sense, you know, right here includes green Tara, or Yamantaka, or Shakyamuni Buddha, or whatever you're practicing. It's right here in the perceptual process. Because we're constructing this. We're in the perceptual process, and the essence of us in the perceptual process, when we're aware of our essence, is our Tara nature, or our Buddha nature, or what have you. So it really is Tara that's grading all those student papers at the end of the term. Yeah, when it works, when you got it going. You know.
For you.
Yeah, well, the way it works for me is it's not exactly Tara grading the papers, but I mean, I can aspire to that, and I do aspire to that, and that's the message of about the flapping flag by my interpretation. Now, of course, there are many other interpretations that don't make any sense to me, so I'm not even going to read them to you, but this is the one that makes sense to me. So, as time goes on, I'll share some more Hui Ning stories, because he really is one of my favorites. And all the little stories about him, they may or may not be true. It's hard to say. I mean, the scholars are debating what is and isn't true. And I don't think it makes any difference, you know. They're good stories, and they illustrate something important. So I'll share some others with you. Okay. So, do we have any questions at this point, or shall I turn this thing off? Yeah.
Could you explain the second turning again?
Sure. Well, the monk says it's not the pennant that's moving, it's the wind that's moving, and therefore the pennant moves in response to the wind that's moving. So the wind is the cause and the movement of the pennant is the effect. Right? So one of the essential points of the Mahayana turning, the second turning of the wheel, is that everything that appears to be whole and independent, and appears to be something that carries its own nature. So when you look at a chair, it seems like a coherent whole. It seems like it's just sitting there, and it's obviously just a chair and nothing else. Now, if you ask, well, okay, what makes chairness, for example? Okay, then that becomes an interesting question. You say, well, it's for sitting on. I mean, the nature of a chair is something that you sit on. That's how you know it's a chair, right? Well, I can sit on the table over there, but I don't call that a chair. I call it a table. Why is that? Well, it's because I eat on the table and I sit on a chair. Well, not necessarily. I can eat on a chair. just as easily. I can sit down. I could, you know, put a dinner plate on a chair and eat on the bun. So where is the chairness of the chair? Now, our mind, immediately when you look at a chair, just, there's a chair. But when you begin analyzing, what you begin to recognize is that there are a lot of linguistic conventions and presumptions that are involved in just saying, well, that's a chair. But if you actually try and define what is a chair, pretty soon you run into various kinds of problems. I mean, I don't have a dictionary with me to do it, you know, to look at what the dictionary definition is. But you'd see there's a certain kind of arbitrariness that's involved in it. So chairness is not something that is inherent in the chair. It's coming from my mind, and it's coming from social agreements. It's not something that's in that object. Not only that, if you look at the chair and you want to, and you think about it as an object, you know, well, you know, there's cloth, there's wood, there's screws, there's glue, you know, it's like, it, is the chair in the wood? Is the chair in the cloth of the seat cushion? Is the chair in the screws? No, it's in the concatenation. It's in the aggregation. It's in the compoundedness of all of those elements. But all of those elements are only hanging together temporarily. 20 years ago, there was no chair. I mean, I know that because I bought it 15 years ago and it was brand new. 20 years ago, there was a tree. And, you know, I don't know. The cloth is probably made out of plastic, so there was oil in the ground, or, you know. And before that, there were dinosaurs or whatever, you know, produced the oil. So it's only because I look at the chair within a sliver of time that I see it as being a whole. The Mahayana view is that the reality of the chair is not associated with that specific sliver of time. It's associated with something vaster. So it arises and it passes away in time. It arises at one point and it passes away. So it's not real in the way you naively take it to be real when you just look at it. The first turning is about, well, we just talk about what's naively real and we don't worry about analyzing that. You know, we have other things that we're concerned about. The second turning, the Mahayana turning, is about, no, we can actually find liberation by understanding the actual nature of things. So let's look at those things. But you can see that that requires a much more sophisticated mind than the teachings of realism, right? I mean, if you're thinking about the Buddha walking around 2,500 years ago, and he walks into a village, and, you know, somebody says, you know, I can't stand my mother-in-law anymore, you know, my husband beats me, all I'm doing is I'm just sort of a slave here in this household, and, you know, what can I do about it? And the Buddha says, well, if you want to, you can leave the household and become a nun, you know, and live that particular life. And that will solve a certain kind of problem, a certain kind of suffering that you're experiencing. And then the woman says, wow, okay, I'll do that. And I use that example because there are stories, there are poems of the early nuns who literally say, oh, this is so great. No mortar and pestle, no mother-in-law. No husband. It's just, I'm so free. This is so wonderful, you know. They wrote poems about this kind of thing because it was such a wonderful experience to be freed from that kind of oppressive social situation. Well, the Buddha doesn't say to this woman, oh, it's only, you know, it's only passing. It's only temporary. The reality is that, you know, this is all a concatenation of circumstances. Your mother-in-law, you know, she's the result of all this kind of karma from the past, and this is only a temporary situation, whatnot. It's like, this lady is uneducated. This woman is uneducated. This way of thinking doesn't mean anything to her. What means to her, what is a teaching that will be meaningful to her? A teaching that will be meaningful to her, you know, has to do with living a different kind of life, understanding your characteristics as a person in a different way, your social situation in a different way, stepping out of it, not being attached to things. So, you know, it's a very kind of realistic sort of analysis. But you're a more sophisticated person, and therefore a more philosophical analysis would make sense to you in a way it wouldn't make to someone who never went to school, 2,500 years ago, who went to school, you see.
Could you give an example of the Theravada, like you were doing last night, to us about, you know, how that works.
What
the process is of Theravadan practice.
Like so mindfulness?
Huh? Yeah.
Well, most of the kind of practices that, I mean, if you think about the practices that are associated with the first turning of the wheel, they're mostly things about the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path of how to live, and right behavior, right morality, these kinds of things. So understanding that if you steal, there's a consequence, right? And that you can actually meditate on understanding the consequences of immoral behavior, that there are consequences to lust that may be problematic. And you can meditate on the characteristics of lust and the consequences of that. So those are Theravada type of practices. They're also included in the Mahayana, but the Mahayana is vaster. It includes other kinds of things. I think that that's enough. I don't want to go into that too far. Because kind of the thrust of what I wanted to talk about here was the whole notion of how this idea of the mind is what's right in front of us right now, and that's the very mind that becomes Tara, right? And that Tara is not someplace else. Tara is this mind right here, properly organized. That's really the thrust of what I wanted to deal with this evening.
Yeah, can I say something in regards to
that? Of course.
The Tara part. I'm just curious, in your experience of meditating Green Tara or Shakyamuni Buddha, I mean, what I have found over and over again is that I'll be arising as that in being, and I'll continually want to put it in front of me instead of perceiving my body as Tara or perceiving my body as Shakyamuni Buddha. Do you guys have that experience at all? That it's... Do you
external.
Yeah, that it's an external thing. And it's kind of interesting when you're saying that, because it's like a constant battle when I'm doing Yamataka. Anything, it doesn't matter what it is, I'm always wanting to put it out there instead of perceiving my...
Right. But if you see that out there is your mind, then it's no different than being inside your skin or being outside of your skin. Because, see, the stance that you're taking is... out there is other than me.
Right.
But out there isn't other than you. Because out there is constructed in your mental space. This is your mental space. I mean, this is a living room, but this is your mental space because it's represented in your mind. Well, that's what your experience is a representation. It's a mental representation. You're not experiencing the actual physical living room. Nobody can do that. All you can experience is the representation. So when you tend to put Tara out there, what you're doing is you're still putting Tara in your mind. It's just you've forgotten that out there is still your mind, because you want to have your mind inside your skin.
Sometimes.
Well, in this particular case.
Yes.
You know, I mean, you know, the typical way that we think about the world is that my mind is in the world. Here I am in the world, my mind is in the world. What we don't think about is that the world is actually in my mind. I mean, that's very antithetical to the way Americans think. It's probably antithetical to the way almost anybody thinks. But really, the world is in your mind. It's not the other way around. And if you think clearly about it, even commonsensical, you know, Western psychological way of thinking about things, we understand that the world is that this is a representation. So if this is a representation, where is that representation? Well, it's in our mind, or it's in our consciousness. But we don't ever go there. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, I think about physicians, for example. You know, I mean, a physician can look at you and... what do they see? Skin, organs. I mean, you know, they've done dissections of cadavers. They know what's going on behind the skin, you know, how the organs work. And they can look at you and they can see, well, here's a person whose liver is not functioning really well because their color is off. You know, they see things a little differently than we do. But I kind of don't think that doctors, you know, go through the day you know, looking at bags of bones and pus and whatnot walking up and down the street. You know, they see people. And then they do a turn of mind when they have to be a physician, sort of looking at a physiology rather than a person. And we can experience that. I mean, you know, some doctors have a good bedside manner and some doctors don't. I suspect that the doctors that don't have a good bedside manner are looking at me and seeing a bunch of tubes and organs and, you know, this stuff, and they're not seeing a person. And that bugs me. Wait a minute, I'm a person. I'm not a bunch of tubes and organs. You know, stop that. Treat me as a person. So I'm saying, you know, do that turn. But, you know, I mean, how could they go through life just seeing, you know, tubes and bags of bones? That would be pretty hard for them. So there's probably a back and forth thing, just like we think our minds are in the world because we spend all our time engaged with the world, forgetting that the world is in our mind. It's like that's the doctor metaphor, if you will.
What's the relationship of Vajrayana to the three turnings?
Vajrayana is a version of the second and the third turnings together. I don't think that the Buddhists would say that too much. The Dalai Lama, for example, would say, so maybe I'm being simplistic, the Dalai Lama would say that Vajrayana is a specific Mahayana practice. But then if you were to ask, so how does it work, then you'd find that all the explanations, they say, well, the explanation is based upon the Chittamatra, mind-only school of thought, which is the third turning. That's what I say, it's really both. But maybe I'm a heretic if I say that sort of thing. But that's the way it's always seemed to me.
Essentially, two and a half.
Or maybe it's four. Or actually, I guess two plus three was five. Yeah. Two plus three would have to be five. It's the fifth turning. Uh-oh, now we're really in trouble. There is no fifth turning.
There is a fifth, but there's no fourth.
Oh, that's it. There's a fifth and no fourth. Uh-oh. This is getting pretty out there, isn't it? All right. Should I turn this off now?